Hello, welcome back to the Res-Up. We are here with University of Regina Professor Shadia Drew. She's also the Canada Research Chair in Social Justice, also the author of several books, most recently Terror and Civilization, Christianity, Politics, and the Western Psyche. Hello, Shadia.
Hi. Hi, Jeff. How are you?
I'm doing great. It's great to speak with you. I'd like to start by asking you your comments. There's been a lot of news and coverage about September 11th, the five-year anniversary, and Prime Minister Harper came out and made a lot of comments about how this is a war of our values, our culture, and this war against terror is a war of civilizations. I'd like to hear your comments on what you think about that war of civilizations.
Well, first of all, I don't think that the war on terror is a real war. I think it's a metaphorical war, like the war on poverty, or the war on drugs, or something of that sort. And secondly, I think that it's not a war of a clash of civilizations, precisely because we don't have, even if we assume it's a clash of civilizations, the thing that Harper and following and echoing Bush are saying is that we have a right to defend our values. Well, no, we don't have a right to defend our values and our way of life if that way of life involves basically exploiting other people. We don't have a right to defend a way of life that presupposes exploiting other people, taking their resources, bombing their cities, killing their kids, you know, destroying entire, office buildings and apartment buildings, entire blocks of apartment buildings, because we suspect there's someone there who is opposed to our dominance of the world. I think the war on terror, if anything, is a metaphor for American domination, world domination. It's a kind of a quest for global tyranny, and I don't think anyone has a right to that.
Do you think that often Harper and Bush, particularly Harper, he's been closing speeches with God bless Canada, and Bush especially often evokes religious symbols in a lot of his comments about the war on terror. I think that the war on terror actually has a religious undercurrent or basis to it.
Well, interestingly, I mean, the conflict is between two sides that are very, very similar. The language of Osama bin Laden and the language of Bush and Harper are very similar kinds of language. They're language of crusades. And ultimately, Osama bin Laden considers the war in Iraq to be the neo-Christian crusaders. He calls them the neo-Christian crusaders and their Zionist allies. And Bush has described it as a crusade, and this constant God bless America, God bless Canada also reveals that they see the world in terms of extreme dualism, that we are on the side of God and our enemies are on the side of Satan. Well, Osama bin Laden also sees the world in this dualistic way. Unfortunately, the world is much more complex than people like Bush and Harper expect it to be or assume that it is. And as a result, they like to see everything in black and white. These are our friends and these are our enemies. But as a result, they don't succeed in taking advantage of the divisions within the Islamic world itself. And for example, divisions between Al-Qaeda, for example, and the Taliban on one hand. And even between Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, there were some very serious fissures. But let's say Al-Qaeda and the Taliban on the one hand and Iran on the other, they like to think that all their enemies are equally evil and are all the same. And this has been a disastrous source of, it's been the source of much of the Bush administration's bungling in the Middle East, you know. So that's one of the problems. I mean, you know, even if you have read Machiavelli, you know, you would know that the easiest thing to do is to take down a dictatorship. You know, there's nothing easier than invading a country that's ruled by a dictatorship. You know, according to Machiavelli's sort of self-help manual, you start by exterminating the tyrant and his closest associates. Next, you proceed, you know, to win over the people. that is generally quite easy because the loyalty to a tyrant doesn't run very deep because the primary motive of that kind of loyalty is profit. So all you have to do is allow the people to live as they did before. I mean, this is just Machiavellian politics 101. But what did the Bush administration do, you know, in a socialist economy like Iraq? They dismissed everyone working for the government, which included all the people in the army, the civil service, the state-owned oil industry. You know, why? So they can be welcome to the brave new world of free enterprise, the brave new world of our way of life, our values. I mean, this is silly. These aren't our values. We are actually, there are a lot of debate in our country and in the United States about whether this untrammeled, unbridled capitalism is really good, is really represents our values. But these are the kind of values that are, you know, Iraq was an experiment to put these values into practice, values that we don't ourselves accept as supreme values. So the Iraqis were told that they were now free to compete for contracts with multinational corporations such as Halliburton. The truth is, I mean, the people of Iraq, most of them lost their livelihoods. And as a result, you know, America's enemies multiplied exponentially. So, that's the problem.
I know you've done a lot of work on researching the political right in the United States, and especially the intellectual undercurrents. So, in kind of referring to Iraq and what are known as the neocons, what do you see as the major intellectual influence on their strategy for Iraq and what they've done with the war on terror?
I have written a lot about Leo Strauss and his connection to the neoconservatives, but Strauss's connection to the neoconservatives is not a simple, you know, or direct kind of connection. You know, many of the neoconservatives have never read Strauss.
Sure.
And but what they share with him is a kind of aversion to liberal society, a sense that somehow liberal society is destructive and dangerous, and it's destructive and dangerous precisely because it allows all this freedom, and they see freedom in terms of licentiousness and in terms of vice. And of course, you know, when we're free, we are not always going to make the right decisions, and a free society has to have a certain amount of tolerance towards vice. But if we have no tolerance, zero tolerance for vice, we're never going to have freedom. We might as well have virtue police the way the Taliban did, the way Iran does, you know. So I think we have to choose between freedom and virtue. We can't choose both as the fundamental and primary value.
I don't know if you've really done a lot of research into Prime Minister Harper's intellectual roots, but I know that a lot of the work that you've done with some of the political right in the States, you come up on a lot of themes, and like you mentioned, they might not have read Strauss or necessarily be Strauss.
But they do share this aversion to liberal democracy, the liberal part of democracy. They're willing, actually, to use democracy to defeat liberalism because they understand, as William Crystal and people like that, the founding father of neoconservatism, is that there is a distinction to be made between liberalism and democracy. These are two different traditions altogether in the history of the West, and they're not necessarily altogether compatible. It has been over 300 years of development in our society that these two traditions have enmeshed with each other. And actually, there is a sense in which they kind of counterbalance each other's defects. Certainly liberalism puts a large brakes on democracy. It sets limits to the tyranny of the majority, for example. It guarantees individuals and minorities' rights so that they can't really be trampled over by majority rule. It insists on limits on government powers, on executive power, for example, and the rule of law. All of these are the liberal elements. And I personally see neoconservatism as using democracy in order to undermine and undercut the liberal elements within liberal democracy. So in other words, using democracy and populism, or populism which is radical democracy, to destroy the freedoms that it has taken us 300 years of liberal revolutions to win over.
And do you think that this is that kind of attack of neoconservatism on liberal democracy has been obviously, do you think it's been successful in the United States? And if so,
yes.
What tactics have the neoconservatives been successful in using?
Well, there are two particular tactics that I think have been very successful. One is to turn people against their own liberty by showing them that liberty leads to, you know, children out of wedlock, drugs, you know, all sorts of things. In other words, to show them that liberty leads to vice and licentiousness. And the other is, of course, through fear, to fill them with a sense of foreboding and a sense of fear that they will have to give up their liberty in exchange for security. Yeah.
And do you see that some of these currents might be translating into initiatives that conservatives in Canada are kind of undertaking?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely. I think that the preoccupation with virtue, for example, same-sex marriage, if we take that as an example, the whole, you know, attitude of the new conservatives like Harper is really an attitude that is hardly different at all from that of the Pope. The Pope has censured Canada and said that Canada has departed from the values of the Catholic Church by allowing same-sex marriage, by allowing abortion. Now, it seems to me the Pope is telling us something very interesting about what the values of the Catholic Church are and what it means to be Catholic. It seems that it's not enough to simply abide yourself and your family by the values and principles of Catholicism, namely abstaining from abortion, abstaining from same-sex marriage. It seems that what's required to be a good Catholic is to make sure that everyone around you also abstains from these things, to, in other words, to impose your own values on them, your own private morality on them. So, and I really think that kind of view is basically to deprive people of making their own choices when it comes to their own private lives is profoundly anti-liberal.
Because do you think that there's a form of manipulation or persuasion that's used a lot of the times by the political right? Because there's one thing, especially about Stephen Harper, that's kind of represented in the media, that he's a bit of an enigma. He's a private man. He doesn't. There's been speculation about what his position really is about religion in the state. Although every once in a while you kind of get these kind of glimmers of him being quite radical in his kind of neoconservative views, but no one really can tell. Is there part of, what can you tell me about kind of the strategy of trying to display yourself one way, and perhaps this relates to how the neoconservatives have been so successful in the States, but displaying yourself one way and communicating to yourself to try and be, centrist in the Canadian kind of political spectrum, but also appealing to that radical base.
Yeah. Well, I think the media in Canada has been very soft on Stephen Harper and his party, and they have really helped him a great deal in presenting himself to the Canadian public as a born-again moderate. You know,
yeah.
Which is very far from reality. Of course, he has muddled his entire party. He completely is a control freak as far as allowing them to speak freely, because he knows that ultimately their values go contrary to the liberal traditions of this country. And I don't mean liberal in a big L liberal.
Mm-hmm.
A small L. I have to confess that I was happy when the Conservatives got a minority government, because I thought the Liberals needed to have a little be taught a little bit of a lesson. But at the same time, I'm surprised at how much change they have managed, how much the country has changed in the few months that they've been in power, and how much damage they've been able to do in such a short time. I think secrecy is a very large part of the strategies of neoconservatives, precisely because what they intend is a kind of a radical reactionary revolution, a turning, what they call in their own words, of turning the clock back on the liberal revolution. I mean, I don't think liberalism is a panacea, and I think it should it should be criticized, but I would rather it be criticized more openly rather than secretively and secretively undermined and in a kind of secretive way.
It also seems like they target fairly marginalized groups. Like, for one thing, intellectuals are often targeted as, you know, this kind of this left-wing conspirators.
I've moved from Calgary, from Alberta in Calgary, to the University of Regina in Saskatchewan, and I find a huge difference in the attitude towards the university and towards intellectuals in this province versus Alberta. In Alberta, we were seen as kind of the disruptive counterculture, you know, and worst of all, not only a disruptive force in society, but a disruptive force that actually costs them money, since they have to pay us. But in Saskatchewan, the government considers the university and intellectuals as a resource, some people to help them figure out how to build a better society. I think that the two different attitudes are completely diametrically opposed.
I was going to ask you, I know you spent some time at the University of Calgary, what do you think of the Calgary School label of the Canadian neocons and their influence on Canadian politics?
Well, I think it's very well deserved. And certainly Preston Manning used to consider the political science department of which I was a part to be certainly his sounding board and his home and his source of intellectual support.
And speaking of Preston Manning, I know that his Center for Democracy and these things, and every once in a while you kind of see his speeches or sometimes he has op-eds in the Globe and Mail, and he often talks about the importance of civil society and getting into civil society to frame debates, to get ideas out, and to really kind of emulate what conservatives in the United States have done over the last maybe 30 years or so, but gaining ground on kind of these civil society debates and words and ideas outside of the quote-unquote politics realm to kind of push a conservative agenda. What do you think of his kind of strategy?
I think he's a nostalgic man, nostalgic for the past, nostalgic for the days when, you know, what he means by people like him mean by civil society is a strong patriarchal family, a strong church, so that people are connected and with the church and the family, and of course by civil society, people like him also mean corporations and capitalism and free trade and things of that sort. And so they want the state basically to the power of the state to devolve to these organizations and to leave corporations as much alone as possible and to give a lot of power to churches and to those kinds of organizations, those kinds of groups. My view of what he means by civil society, much of what he says comes out of the new con, Francis Fukuyama, who writes a lot about civil society in that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you very much for joining us. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
You're very welcome. Nice to talk to you, Jeff.
Okay. Thank you, Shadia.